Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. This week, we have two guests. First, we talk with Patrick Mouratoglou, who, of course, wears many hats in tennis. He keeps the tennis milliners busy. He's a broadcaster. He's a coach. He's a promoter. Today, we talk to him in two capacities. We talk about the UTS, the Ultimate Tennis Showdown, that he ran over the past several weeks. This was an attempt by Patrick to speed up tennis, make it faster, younger, draw a new audience. We talk about what worked and what didn't. We spoke with him in June, and he invited us he said, we'll do a reassessment when we're done and see what we did well and what we need to work on. And so we took him up on that. So a conversation about the UTS, the Ultimate Tennis Showdown. And then we talk about Serena Williams. Patrick, of course, has coached Serena for almost a decade now. And we talk about where she is, what she'll need to do to win that elusive 24th major. He is about to leave Nice for Lexington, Kentucky, from the south of France to the land of Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul. But Patrick is going to meet up with Serena and coach her in Lexington on her way to the U.S. Open. So we talk a lot about Serena Williams, how she's handling pressure, what she needs to do differently if she were to get to the final, and her sort of general disposition during the COVID crisis. So a good conversation. Then we talk with Andrea Leand. Andrea is a former top 15 player, a commentator. She also once did a brief stint as an agent. She was at the Greenbrier for the finals of World Team Tennis the other day. She was sitting courtside. So we talk a bit about tennis and a bit about what the U.S. Open is going to look like under this sort of quasi-bubble configuration. So two good conversations, sort of looking back, but also looking forward. So let's get started in the south of France with Patrick. So we spoke a few months ago before your events began, and we said we would check in, and you were open to suggestion, and you sort of you wanted to hear how this went. So you tell me first. I mean, grade yourself. What worked well?
Most of it. I mean, first, to see the reality of something you've imagined is amazing. It's an incredible feeling. And it was really impressive to see those great champions play. Something that was difficult to imagine, like play a format so different from tennis. The accepting to be in a discomfort zone at the start, because it's very different, it's very stressful, it's very difficult in terms of physical, because you don't have a lot of time between the points, much less, so you can't recover well. You have so much more stress. To see them go through all that in a completely new environment, all the things that go with it, the software we had to develop, this machine we had to develop for the chair umpires that is so different. The whole feeling for me was just incredible, to be completely honest.
You sound to me like you've written a screenplay and then you've actually seen it performed as a movie.
That's a perfect way to put it. Yeah.
What did you think? First of all, what do you think of the level of play? I mean, this was a different environment for the players. They were also coming off a long break. What did you think of the quality of tennis?
I think at the start of UTS 1, the level was really so-so. But after a few weekends, they started to play well. The one who, Berrettini, for example, who won UTS one, I think his level the first two weekends was, wow, was far from very far. And then he took off and then he started to play some of his best tennis, I think. That's why he won. And the level of, I think for UTS two's finals, men and women, I think the level was really good. I think it was very good tennis. That's, I really enjoyed so much watching.
If you had to do it over, what would you do differently? What didn't work as well as you expected?
For me, it's details, but it counts. For example, what I didn't like, but it's not about me because the product is not for me. The product is for the fans, and it's really, really fan-oriented, fan-centered. So we ask the question to the fans a lot and we have a lot of feedback. What I didn't like, and actually it was some of the feedbacks, was the end of the quarters when there was too much difference of points between the two players. Some guys would not really play at all. And like they didn't want to play the last points. So they were just, so this was really, didn't look good. And actually it's sad because some guys just, of course, the people who are against that, they just take this as an example that it's not serious, but I think if we are really honest, the players played with an incredible motivation and all of them. And the final, the fact that they argued during the match, I mean, a guy like Felix, who is definitely not the kind of guy who would do that, it showed how much they cared and they wanted to win.
So one thing I've sort of heard repeatedly, not just on social media, but even, you know, talking to former players is, I credit Patrick. It's a lot of cool innovations. It was a great product. I don't know how transferable any of this is to tour level tennis. What's your response to that?
That was not the goal. And that's not the goal to transfer it to tour tennis. The goal is to have two different leagues. One classic league, ATP WTA Grand Slams, which holds the history of our sport.
Sure.
And these leagues have to continue, I think, to do the same as what they're doing. For one of the main reasons is because the fans, the tennis fans, like it. So why would you change? Right. And the tennis fans of ATP and WTA, the majority of them are very conservative and they would hate changes. So why would you change? So I think that's what's great about UTS is that we have no limits in experimenting. Because we want to do something that is very different from tennis. And the point is not to replace tennis and not to influence classical tennis either. I think we should stay, ATP WTA should stand where they are and we should stand where we are. And I think the mix of both, the fact that we both exist is going to be a great ad for tennis.
You think the market's big enough for both?
Sure. It's not that I think that the market is big enough for both of us. It's that I think that the market will be bigger because we are two. We will grow the market. We will bring to tennis people who are not watching tennis. And then I jump into your second question that you didn't finish. So I'll let you finish. But I'm going to jump.
No. Keep. I mean, it's the same question. Talk about the audience you're bringing in and what you learned.
Yeah. So what I love, we have some data. We have data. So I'll tell you how we got the data. First, from our social medias, because you know that on the social medias, we have a lot of information and data about our fans, and also we have our OTT channel, and we can discuss directly with them, and so we have a lot of data about them also. And so I have two data that I really like, that were, because that was the whole point about it. First, 50% of the UTS fans were not tennis fans, that they were not watching tennis, they were not following tennis. And that's the whole point. We bring people who are not watching tennis to tennis because they're not attracted to a long, slow format. They're attracted to a fast, fun, dynamic format because they're younger and they don't consume long formats. Very as simple as that. So this was good. And second figure is the age of the fans, of our fans. Average is 31 years old. So 31 compared to 61 for tennis. And I know I've heard a lot of things about me saying 61 and like I created those figures. So those figures are into, I take them from studies, very serious studies that have been made on tennis that are available. They're public. They've been made for big medias who do surveys because they need to know who are their audience, et cetera, et cetera. And when we talk about tennis fans, when I talk about tennis fans and this figure, so this figure comes from those studies, again, that are very reliable and anyone can consult them. I just did like anyone could have done. So I'm talking about the people who are following tennis and watching tennis all year long on TV. I'm not talking about the guys who are in the clubs playing tennis. The tennis fans are those people, right? Just to be clear.
What was your size of your audience?
We don't want to give that figure.
You don't want to go there?
No, but we don't give that figure, so I'm not going to give it. But the thing I can say is that the matches were broadcasted in more than 100 countries, and unique viewers, we had more than 20 million.
More than 20 million unique viewers. You'll tell me why you don't want to give that away, but did it meet your expectation? How would you describe that?
Yeah, no, honestly, I couldn't dream about a better start. It's always difficult to launch something new. Always, it's even more difficult to launch something new in a sport that is so conservative as tennis.
There is a global pandemic you had to contend with as well.
Yes, that's true too. But you know, we had, if I take away the top three players, because they're a different league, but out of the top three, so you have seven other players in the top 10. We had five out of the seven who played our tournament, and they were so happy. They were so enthusiastic about it. The feedback from the players was great, and I'm so happy about it, because if they didn't like it, then we just have to close the door. Finished.
So where do we go from here?
Yeah, so where do we go? We definitely need to continue. Again, the goal is to have two leagues next to each other that are complementary, that are completely different, that have different purposes, and that aim to different audiences. So that's why I'm saying it's great, because the goal is to grow the pie of the tennis fans. Go get people that tennis don't get now. People, tennis has more than a billion fans around the planet. It's a huge sport, but it's an old audience, and we want to get also the younger ones. So I think UTS can get this audience. So it's great for the whole industry. So we want to continue. We want to do some other events. There are quite a good number of weeks during the year when we can do it. That's for one thing. And second thing, we will see what the calendar is going to look like after the COVID-19. For the moment, I mean, nobody has a real view about what's going to happen. And also, nobody can say what the calendar is going to look like in 2021.
Sure. No, I mean, I think we all know there are events that were on the calendar before that may not... That may not be back. Were there any differences you noticed between the men and women?
Yeah, I mean, women play longer rallies, so I think it's more difficult for women because, you know, the recovery time is still short between points, but they don't have those huge serves and this ability to close a lot of points very, very fast. But I think also that if they keep playing UTS, they're gonna also adapt, and they're gonna learn to shorten the rallies. To be honest, men had much more time of play than women on UTS, because UTS 1 was only guys, and they played even more matches in UTS 2.
Let me, if I that's an interesting point. If I were gonna play UTS and I wanted to wear a tracking device, if I wanted to get biotech involved, would I be allowed to?
I would love to.
Wearable technology?
This is definitely things we're going to do. I mean, I'm also okay with you coming with a t-shirt that doesn't look like a tennis t-shirt. I'm fine with that. You know, everything is so much in boxes in tennis. I want to open all the boxes and see how, I mean, make it more colorful, more fun, more... but still keep this competition spirit that is so important. And but we have it. We kept it. So that's great.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Wearable technology, I'm telling you. So you mentioned you're going to you're off to Lexington.
Yeah.
What do the next few weeks look like for you?
I hope I would know in advance what's going to happen. You know, the program is Lexington, then Cincinnati, New York, and then New York. The goal is to play to have matches, to have the feel of competition again for Serena. We know how important it is. I mean, you asked me the question about UTS, and I've seen the players improve weekend after weekend because they had more time, competition time. So it's very important for all the players. So that's why we're going to Lexington, because we don't know how many matches she'll be able to play. So let's give us the chances to play as many matches as possible.
Right.
So we'll see how it is. I mean, it's going to be challenging because of the restrictions. But for Serena, it's going to be fine, I think, because she's still during a tournament. She's just in the room or at the stadium, and that's it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you know, we all know how she is during these majors. To what extent is her rhythm going to be disrupted? I mean,
it's not going to be disrupted because, it's not going to change anything for her. Like, she's too famous to do stuff and walk in the street or go to the restaurant. You know, she needs rest during tournaments. I mean, a lot of players can do that, but the top ones, they can't, because, I mean, people come to them all the time, so they never relax. So they have to stay in the room, and she's used she's very used to doing that. So.
Right. What do you think is the factor most critical in her success these next few weeks?
Number one is a preparation, for sure. It's always about that. Probably the second thing that's going to be important is the mindset, because the mindset is, as a consequence, how you handle the situation emotionally is also a lot about your mindset. So we have to work on that. So she, of course, she will feel that she will feel the opportunity to win the 24s. But at the same time, she has to go there with the same motivation, but take some pressure away, because on those moments, the pressure goes to the ceiling, because and to play one match for the history is probably the highest pressure you can experience in your life.
So as coach, what do you tell? I mean, I think you're right, and I think it's you watch even from a distance, and it's pretty clear that there is this ratcheting up of tension. How could there not be? What do you tell her?
I should tell her something different from the previous four times. First, I don't want to tell you what I said that didn't work.
I was gonna say, you got to tell. What did you tell her?
If it works tomorrow. No, first of all, to be completely honest, and I thought I knew her really well, and I thought I was really good at reading people, because I feel that's my job. I didn't feel that coming at all. Like, I didn't feel any extra stress before those finals.
Really?
No. I didn't feel at all. I don't even know if she did feel something, to be honest. I mean, you know, when you have extra pressure, it always highlights your weaknesses, always. That's the rule in sport. So I feel that the first finals that she's reached after her pregnancy, she was not back 100% physically. She was winning, yes, because she's an incredible competitor, because she's has so much experience, because she has such a huge game. But, I mean, clearly she was far from her level in terms of fitness. So this just, I think on those pressure moments, this came back too strong, and it hurt her. So, I mean, and when you realize that, you feel like, okay, so, I mean, we never faced any kind of problem. I mean, Serena's always great under pressure. That's one of her trademarks. So, I mean, if you look at her career, I don't think it's something you can discuss. So I have no reason to think that she's not going to be great under pressure. I shouldn't anticipate something that shouldn't happen. So I thought, okay, anyway, time is working for her because the more time passes, the better in shape she is. She keeps working. So, yeah. And then, you know, it doesn't work a third and a fourth time. So you have to think, okay, so there is something extra that we need to work on.
Right. So keep going. Let's role play this. If hypothetically she wins six matches at the U.S. Open and she's on the threshold of history, and this is the fifth major post-pregnancy, fifth major final, what do you tell her?
I can't tell you now because I don't know.
You got 4 weeks. You got 5 weeks.
It's important to feel the person. You know,
sure.
when you're with your player on a daily basis, and you always, I mean. I told you that I didn't feel what happened, which is true, but most of the time you also know better how to speak to her because you are in you feel her presence, you feel her, how she feels, how she also communicates with you, and it's easier also to be right and to have the right words when you are with a person physically.
Instagram is not always the most accurate indicator of these things. How has she been holding up, and what have you learned about her these last 6 months?
I mean, I don't know if I learned something about her, but I feel her motivation is still intact, which is something very impressive. Like all this COVID-19 again prevented her from being able to achieve what she wants to achieve. Time passes and you can feel like at some point she's going to say, okay, I mean, with everything I've done in my career, all the other things I have on the side, my family, all my business, okay, it's done for tennis. Let's do something else. Motivation is the same.
you haven't seen that drop off. You haven't seen that.
Zero. She's really working the same, focusing the same. I have the feedbacks from the guys working with her, the fitness and also the hitting partner. She's 100%.
Gotcha. So there are two competing schools of thought on this, which is when tennis comes back, this is going to really benefit the top players who have had access to more training and, who are the stronger players to begin with. The other school of thought is it's going to be wide open. And this is how Kim Clijsters can come back and beat the most recent major champion, and that some player ranked 62 could win this major. Two very different schools of thought. Where do you stand?
I would say that it's better for the younger players because the competition is very aggressive for the fitness, and not being able to compete for such a long period and suddenly competing, I think, is going to be really hard. And I think is great for the players if they can play early and compete early in before the US Open. So that's why the one who played UTS, I think you'll see they're going to play great. I think they're super ready, much more than the other guys. So for the younger player, I think they will recover better, faster, and after the matches. On the other hand, I think that the more experienced player will be, you are right that they had better conditions for practice. First, second, they need less competition than others to be at the top of the game. So, and also players who are on the rise, that everything's doing great, it broke the momentum. I mean, I'm not saying they cannot come back, but it killed the momentum.
There's a 16-year-old from that.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Exactly. All right. Last question. What is your favorite book behind you?
Let me have a look.
You like that book with the yellow cover right next to it? Look at the one next to it with the yellow cover.
Next to it with the yellow cover.
With the brown in the middle. Keep going. Other way. Sorry. Yeah, there. Right there.
I don't think I read this one yet.
All right.
You know this one?
Mike Tyson, though, huh?
I love this. This one is unbelievable.
Which Tyson book is that?
It's called Mike Tyson, Undisputed Truth. It's a bestseller, actually. They made a documentary with this book.
Right.
But I think you can watch it. The documentary is unbelievable.
That's Carmelo Anthony, I think. I think that's Carmelo Anthony's Tyson documentary.
Really? It's called Tyson.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Really?
All right. I like that you didn't pick a tennis book.
Yeah.
So this is great. I congratulate you on what you started here.
Did you like it or not? Tell me the truth.
I liked what you did. I liked how you used this as an opportunity. I think some things work better than others. I think you've really caught on to something, and I think that I want to see this when there's no COVID. And you know, will players decide to play this? But I think also the TV picture, you'll have fans in the stands. I mean, I think this, I think it's intriguing. I think you've got a lot of people thinking, and I think it's going to be interesting to see if this can happen alongside tour tennis. But I think you really took advantage of this period. I think like you said, I think some of the time, I love speeding up the pace of play. I'm not sure the quarters quite worked. Not sure we needed the nicknames, but I think the big picture is you use this crisis as opportunity, and not everyone did that. So I commend you on that.
Yeah, I mean, if you can just spread the message, I mean, that's not your role, but when you have the opportunity, no, but just to know, just knowing it, and when people say something that is not right, we don't want to replace tennis. That's not the point. I mean, that's the most important thing. It's just next to tennis. It's a plus. It's not to replace or a lot. I mean, I'm asked this question all the time. We don't want to translate stuff to tennis. That was not the idea at all. I'm not saying tennis is not good and we have to make it better. I'm saying tennis is great for some people, but we don't renew our fan base. We need a different product to renew the fan base. That's my whole thing. That's the whole thing I'm saying.
No, I think
that the immersive experience, because it's much more immersive than classical tennis, I think it's very interesting for the fans, because I think it's exciting to be sitting next to the players in a way. That's the feeling that we want to give as much as possible.
And you're committed. Let's be clear. And you're committed to a second season.
100%.
I appreciate this. I congratulate you. Be safe. Wear a mask and get through Lexington, and we might see you here in safer precincts.
Thank you very much, John. Have a good day.
Okay, thanks to Patrick Mouratoglou. Always a pleasure talking with him. The guy we talked about this last time, he could be perhaps a controversial figure, but I think you have to hand it to anyone who is willing to innovate and test things out, and I give him a lot of credit. We'll see how the Ultimate Tennis Showdown what it looks like in its next incarnation, not Ultimate. All right, next up, let's go to Baltimore, Maryland, and talk with Andrea Leand. Andrea is a former player, former top 15 player. She's been around the sport for a long, long time, and she was at the World Team Tennis Finals in the Greenbrier in West Virginia. So we talk about what she observed courtside and what she thought of tennis during the time of COVID, and what the U.S. Open can learn, good and ill, from what we saw the last few weeks at the Greenbrier. All right, let's talk now with Andrea. Hi there.
You were there. You were there for the final weekend of World Team Tennis. Put us there. What was it like?
Oh, it was tremendous. Well, of course, the Greenbrier is a perfect setting, 11,000 acres. The players could do everything from horseback ride to hike and bike and golf. And so they were entertained off court. They were very happy. But what the whole thing became about is creating this bubble, John, and creating a bubble and trying to get pro tennis back to the fans and to see if it could be successful. And Carlos really pulled it off. Carlos Silva did a phenomenal job, the CEO of the World Team Tennis. And it was quite a lot of challenges. It wasn't perfect. You know, Marty Fish was supposed to be on the New York team. He won the golf event in Tahoe and had to pull out. Luke Jensen did a great job. Of course, Kim Claesters got injured on the New York team, and so they had to acquire Coco Vandeweghe in the full Melkor mid-season. Of course, they ended up winning the final match, so that was an incredible twist of fate. And all the tests, you know, there's a lot said about all the COVID tests. And, of course, the players and the staff and media all had to have a test done before they got there. And then they had one done when they got there. And not all the results came back at the same time. So there were some players a little nervous. Of course, you know, Luke and Evan King and Neil, you know, all got their tests back a little bit later. So they couldn't play the first few matches. But everything was negative. Everything got done. And they were able to hurdle all these challenges. Which made it such a success. But I think creating this bubble and sending out the message that that Carlos was going to implement this, not just put strict protocol, but implement the protocol, I think send a message to everyone that you can do this if you do follow through.
Can they replicate this? I mean, the U.S. Open is obviously not one resort where everybody can stay, and we're already hearing about players taking private homes and, their rules about entourage, but they seem to be a bit of a work in progress. I mean, to what extent do you think this can be replicated at the U.S. Open in a few weeks here?
Well, I think that's the big challenge is, as you said, you have it's a much bigger field. Of course, we're not looking at World Team Tennis as the format they need to copy. It's right. Basically about the protocol. And yes, I mean, the USGA now is saying that they have to have security around the clock if they're going to stay privately. They have to, you know, make sure that their whereabouts are definitely checked on so that they're not exposed to anything. And so I think the USGA is going to do its very best to try and create this bubble, as are other tournaments. But I do agree, John, the coaches are a little bit concerned. You know, will they be able to replicate that at the events where players have, you know, obviously more freedoms and have to have more of a judgment call as to their behavior? I think that the tournaments in Lexington and Cincinnati, of course, we're playing Cincinnati right before the Open in New York. That is going to be a big telltale sign if the players, and not just the players, but their entourages are really going to adhere to the rules, because that's the whole key. You need the negative test. As everyone said at World King Tennis, once all those negative tests came back, that was really, the key to being a successful event.
The devil's advocate would say there were, you know, nobody tested positive, which is great, but you did see people without masks, and you did see something less than social distancing. First tell me sort of about the climate on the ground. Did you witness some of this stuff as well?
Yeah, you know, they only let in about 200 or 300 fans, and I sat front row. I had the whole row to myself. It was definitely social distancing in the stands, but no, none of the fans had masks on. Most of them did not have masks on. And so you do wonder about that, you know, of course, there are not going to be any fans apparently at the U.S. Open, so that should not be an issue. But should everyone be required to wear a mask if they're off court, if they're not actually playing, no matter who they are? That's a good question to ask. I did ask a few people. I said, are you a little nervous that the fans aren't wearing masks? Right. And they said, no. And the players did wear masks off court. I remember, you know, Sonia Kennan and her dad coming right out of their hotel room, had the mask on, went down the elevator, mask on, game face on. So at some point, I do think that the players at the Greenbrier were able to make that transition from worrying about the COVID protocol to worrying about the tennis and letting that be the stage. And I think that's the whole trick there, is to try and get through the protocol so that the tennis then can become the real highlight and the real stage of the event.
Strictly from a tennis standpoint, who impressed you? I got a lot of texts about Brandon Nakashima, the kid from UVA, who I guess is now, I think he just turned 19, but now is going pro. Who impressed you?
Brandon is absolutely the youngest in the event, apparently, of course, a year at UVA. He has that blistering backhand, great attitude. It's just such a terrific attitude for a young teenager. Of course, you know, he had the team with Jeannie Bouchard. You saw the Instagram. It's, you know, a lot of fun off court. But he was all business on court. He was able to keep his concentration and his focus, especially against Jack Sock. You know, rooted Jack Sock, bageled him in that final, which really turned the momentum for Chicago at that point in the final. But he did not bat an eye, which you like to see that composure from a young teenager. Sonia Kennan, too. Jane Face John, she was not having anything of it, and she was not happy when they lost in the semis. She got on that golf cart with her father, and off they went on to the next stop. But that's what the good thing is about Sonya. I think that this has become a great barometer for her and Sloane and other players there to see where they are and where they need to be by the U.S. Open. Sloane, to me, she's been doing a lot of weightlifting. Talked to Kamau about it during this, you know, sabbatical for the COVID. A lot of weightlifting and a lot of muscle. But as we all know, it's her feet, not the muscle, that wins matches for her. And she's going to have to go back to that hardcore training of doing the foot speed, the work, the sprints, the non-glamorous part of it, and get that type of quick twist back into her game. She is supposed to go to Lexington, but I think that's where she needs to be when she gets to the U.S. Open. She's got to have those feet again. And so I think it has become a great barometer for those players.
You mentioned Jack Sock, who is obviously trying to restart his career. Did you like what you saw there?
Well, Jack Sock is such a fun player to watch for me. I love watching Jack Sock. He is such a great athlete. He has so much talent. He showed the Grand Slam doubles form there. He was just absolutely dominant, whether he was hitting the ball or not. And usually he was all over the court. He has such enormous strength that he was just able to overpower everyone in the doubles. And just, he knows the doubles court so well. And he has great confidence in himself there. But, of course, in the singles, he didn't win a game. He'd already played the first two matches, got a little tired there, the speed is the issue, the fitness. But he does look in better shape to me. He does look more confident. And it would be so great for American tennis to have Jack Sock back again. I will say, he is the total team player, John. When Coco went to play Sloane in the women's singles in the final, he was mid-court ball-boying for the girls. And, of course, you know, a little bit of chiding of Sloane, you know, screaming out to Coco, you know, come on, Coco, all the pressure's on her, you can do this. And so it was all in the works down there. All the storylines were in play, which made it a lot of fun.
Jack Sock heckling Sloane. I'd heard about that. everybody, as I understand, a lot of people driving now to Lexington. What do you expect there?
Well, of course, Venus Williams was there. She showed up, great name to have, great supporter of team tennis. She played for Washington. Also a good barometer for her, of course, in the end tail of her career. She actually went back to Washington to train, and everyone's doing the drive. Everyone's doing the caravan. Kamau told me that he and Sloane were going back to Chicago, and then they're driving to Lexington. So I think everyone kind of wants to keep that bubble concept in place where they're in their car, they have their car down to tournament, and they really can have that type of isolation. So, yeah, no flights, no jets yet that I'm hearing about, but I'm sure we will have a few. But right now the players trying to stay in the mode of, sticking to themselves.
And I know some players expect to drive from Lexington to New York and just won't mess with airports at all.
Yeah, the airports is a real tough one. And, obviously a lot of them are not going to, pay for these jets. And that has its own issues too now, apparently. But, yeah, they're going to drive. And it's not that bad. And they do have their entourages. They can take the whole team. They don't have to be – the airports are a real, real tough one as far as exposure. And I don't think anyone is looking forward to going to the airports. Now, of course, apparently Jeannie Bouchard's going to Europe. But the rest of them, yes, they're looking for the caravan car rides into New York.
We said last week, if one player is not going to get a USTA U.S. Open wild card, it's probably Jeannie Bouchard. But what Instagram is one thing, and even press conferences to some extent. But what was your real sense of how players are dealing with this? What is the level of concern and how is this manifesting itself on the tennis? I mean, this is something that none of us have been here before, but especially with a limited shelf life to have a sports career. How are these athletes handling this? What did you witness?
Well, I think the Greenbrier did a great job. It's such a beautiful resort. There's so much to be able to do without having to worry about all the protocol, because that is the key, John. I mean, when you have that worry about having to, be exposed or follow a protocol and then have to play your best tennis, you have to make that transition mentally onto the court, that once you get on court, that's it. You turn off all the issues and you just focus on your tennis. But it also has to be for the practices leading up to there, so they're prepared, they're ready to go to play the matches, especially in the heat and humidity of New York. And so that will be the key, is to see which teams can just say, you know what, you worry about the tennis and we'll worry about everything else. And you just go ahead and you do your routine. And that's what the USTA's challenge is going to be. They're going to have to create an environment where the players can get there and just worry about doing their routine for their tennis and playing their best game so they can produce the best matches and the best, of course, sport for the fans. And to me, that's what the USTA needs to do in creating the bubble, is to create a sense of security for the players that everyone's fine, all the protocol has been done and put into place, and you can just worry about your tennis now. And, that's where the teams also are going to come into play. I think it's going to be, it's going to be interesting to see. I think that it's all about getting these negative tests. As they told me at the Greenbrier, the staff is, once we got all the negative tests and we realized it could be done, it was a big sigh of relief. And I think once that happens, in the Cincinnati week of the U.S. Open, if they can get through that and get through that hump, I think then they'll have a bit of a sigh of relief going into the Open. And if they stick to their guns on what they say, I think that it becomes a whole new animal if you start inviting fans in and you start inviting other people in, with daily passes and things, and you start kind of penetrating the bubble, then it becomes a whole different thing. And I think players are cognizant of that. So it's really up to the USTA, I think, to keep a firm, firm grip on that bubble.
So having sat front row for pro tennis and having talked to players and coaches, I mean, what is your level of concern / optimism for the U.S. Open? I mean, where, having spent last weekend in Greenbrier, you more or less optimistic than you were a week ago?
Well, the great thing about the Greenbrier is that Carlos and World Team Tennis and the staff took care of everything. Right. And so from their hotel rooms to their eating to their lounges and so forth. So everything was taken care of. Now, as a tournament in New York, obviously the USTA is going to do their best and they have the hotels and the transportation and so forth. But there's going to be a little bit of discretion of decision-making left up to the player and player team. And so, look, I can tell you that I think the most seasoned veterans and the smart ones and the managers behind them are going to do the right thing. But you have 128 players in both singles draws. That's a lot of players, a lot of lower ranked players without teams to help them make the right decisions. And those are the people you worry about. So I think that it's also not a team event. It's everyone for themselves and for himself. And so you worry that someone may not make the right decision. So again, the USTA is going to have a huge, huge player staff in place to really deal with all this.
I my only pushback on that would be, I would be more concerned about private housing than people staying at the tournament hotel. I mean, I just don't know, if you're trying to create a bubble, I'm not sure how private housing is consistent with that. And who knows, or is everyone going through one realtor? Who knows who's been in and out of this property? Has the property been vetted? I almost think that the risk is going to come from one of the higher ranked players who have an entourage and who have a private rental. Then, it's easy to go back and forth to a tournament hotel, right? I mean, I worry more about the upper level player who's staying in a rental property than the run of the mill player who's staying at the tournament hotel. You buy that?
Well, yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, I think, look, there's going to be there's going to have to be sacrifice too. Kamal said this. All the coaches all told me this. There's going to have to be sacrifice, and the players and the top players are going to have to realize this is not going to be the most fun 3 or 4 weeks, and you're going to have to make sacrifices. You're going to have incredible discipline, and they're going to have to apply all those things they use in their tennis to now their lifestyle, and that is going to be interesting. As you said, yeah, I mean, look, these private homes, there are a lot of open doors there, as we all know, but I have to hope that the top players especially want to win the tournament, and they have to test negative to do that. And having a team member who exposes them is not going to help that. So you have to hope they look at the big picture and do the right thing and have the right amount of discipline. But as we all know, John, I hear you. It's a tough one.
Yeah, no, I mean, honestly, I think one thing that's characterized not just tennis and not just the U.S. Open and not just sports, I mean, opinions are all over the map, and you have one person whose opinion you respect saying this will be a pretty much normal major and players don't go out that much anyway and it's not going to be that different, and you have other people saying this is going to be a complete catastrophe and they're going to be lucky to get week one played. So, I mean, I guess we're all sort of we'll see what happens with all of this. But there is not a lot of consensus about a lot of issues surrounding this tournament, and I guess we hope for the best.
Well, I think you're right, John. I think that there are going to be problems they're going to present very quickly in the Cincinnati week, the first week of in New York. I think it will present very, very quickly. I don't think this is going to be something that will happen. If they get to the third week, I think they will have figured it out by then. But that first week is going to be crucial. And it's all in the details. It really is going to be all in the details. And that is going to be, you know, having the staffing, having everything, you know, outlined so that they're going to have to adjust like Carlos did at World Team Tennis. It's not going to be perfect. And it's how you adjust. It's how you're able to make those decisions, quick second decisions, to make the tournament continue in a healthy, you know, safe way is going to be what's pivotal. But are you going to get out there and are you going to go?
I am still waiting to hear about the media policy. I do not anticipate going, and I was told also, you know, don't try to meet up with players. Don't try to go to the tournament hotel. You know, it's whatever I am, eight miles away from the site, but I suspect I may as well be in a cabin in Mongolia. We'll be doing this by Zoom like we've been doing everything else. But no, I think it will be a real test for tennis. I'm not quite sure what to think, honestly. I mean, on the one hand, I give the USTA a lot of credit. I think they've done this really thoroughly and with a lot of caution. I also think 256 athletes from all over the world coming to one venue is sort of an anathema to maximum health and safety. So I sort of am guardedly optimistic and concerned, and yet I think the USTA should come in for some real credit here. For making this thing happen and doing so with real caution and an embrace of science. So we'll see. It will be an open like no other.
I think that, you know, as you said, I think people forget the magnitude of how many, we're talking about hundreds of people just with the players and their entourages. In the Greenbrier, you had 19. It was a more controlled setting with 19. When you have, you know, 120, about 250 players and their entourages, just allowing the players one person into the player, you know, dining and lounge facilities there, that adds, you know, that adds another 250. So then you have 500 people in there. So, you know, the odds, as you say, the odds go up significantly with the numbers you have. And it'll be interesting to see how the USTA utilizes the facility to be able to handle all this. Because, you know, it can get kind of cozy in that tunnel in those player areas.
No, it's tunnels. And the other thing I've heard that there are people on both tours that are agitating as the tournament goes on and there are fewer players in the draw, maybe that entourage bubble will be able to expand. So I think, you know, we'll see how this all plays out. No one has been here before. And I think you're right. I think there's going to be a lot of policy done on the fly and a lot of snap decisions. You know, I think there are going to be a lot of sort of very important calls that are going to have to be made spontaneously, right? What do we do?
Well, I will say. Go ahead. I will say one thing. And Carlos had to take a real firm stance, especially with the Daniel Collins issue when she left. And as though she didn't mean anything by it, but he had to take a stance and he had to say, okay, you know, you're out of here. If the USTA makes too many exceptions and the players sense that, then that could be an issue. So this is where they have to be able to be willing also to show the discipline to take the stances and follow through on all the rules and regulations they're handing out right now.
Yeah, and you know, there are we all know this, right? That there are different levels of discipline. We've seen this 100 times, right? I mean, different players are treated differently depending on their ranking and their star appeal, and does Daniel Collins get the same treatment as a top five seed? We'll see. But lots to, you know, I think we're all sort of nervously and voyeuristically going to be looking on here. And I appreciate
Well, I do give credit. Yeah, I mean, I give a lot of credit to Stacey Allister and the USTA for attempting this. And I think that if anyone can pull it off, they can pull it off because they have such great experience. And I think they were looking in the Greenbrier. I think they're looking at World Team Tennis. as that model as to what to do, what needs to be adjusted. You know, obviously the format was different and it was easier with the bubble with the Greenbrier, but I do think that all these things will help them. I think looking at Lexington next week is going to be able to help them as well. And so by the time they get to the Open, hopefully they would have worked out all the kinks and everyone will be on the same page.
I think that's a good point. I think that's a really good point too, that they do have two events to learn from after World Team Tennis. And I also do think it's probably worth pointing out the situation in New York is really improved, both sort of out on the street and also just that the data is now mirroring the data in, you know, South Korea and the U.S. You know, New York right now is better than Australia. So I think people from overseas especially are seeing some very grim statistics about the U.S., but I would stress that that is not the situation in New York. So anyway, this is great. I've got to run. You've got to run. This is it's always a pleasure talking, and I'm glad as someone who's actually seen pro tennis live and in person, I was eager to get your impressions, and I thank you. I thank you for giving them.
Well, thank you, John. I really had a ball at the World Team Tennis. It really was fun, and I appreciate you. Yeah, I always love talking to you, and I thank you, and let's keep our fingers crossed.
If tennis can keep riding this momentum from West Virginia, we'll all be better off. So, all right, I will see you down the road, but thanks for visiting today.
Thanks. Thank you.
All right, take care. Thanks, Andrea.
All right, thanks to Andrea. Thanks to Patrick. Thanks, as always, to Jamie, our uber-talented producer. Two good conversations. Again, this is sort of the U.S. Open is back edition, and the range of outcome here is fairly vast for this U.S. Open. A lot of people share this sort of sense of guarded optimism and yet trepidation. We've seen baseball and college football. It has not gone so well in the restart. We've seen other sports, the NBA, and again, I give World Team Tennis credit, that have gone much better. I think the challenge will be for the USTA to sort of replicate this bubble and avoid some of the pitfalls that other sports have made in terms of sort of letting players go out and about when they're not competing. So we will see how this all plays out. I think Andrea raises a really good point that the fact that we have Lexington and Cincinnati preceding the Open will give us a sense of whether this is feasible and sort of what best practices we can adopt and learn from those events. A lot of news. A lot is changing. I mean, literally, since we recorded this, a few more players, including Yelena Ostapenko, has pulled out of the U.S. Open, former major champion Ostapenko. So this, again, we should timestamp this. We are talking on Wednesday. A lot could change by the time you hear this. We will try to keep you posted. All right, that does it for this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks for the guest suggestions. You can subscribe and leave a review. Always helps. You can get this wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Barnes & Noble, Borders, B. Dalton. Thanks, everyone. Thanks to Jamie. And we will do it again in a week. We'll be right back.